Well, comrades, I'm sure you're all of the opinion that it was well worth waiting for.
We're grateful for explaining some of the things and give us a view of the big picture of the broad brushstroke.
So, right, the floor's thrown open to discussion and questions.
Might be a bit of a pointless question, but be interested to hear what you think. The big corporations and the big multinational companies, the food companies that you mentioned, some of them, they all, to greater or lesser degree, have a team or an individual responsible for explaining, publicising their stance on the environment, so their policies regarding recycling and treatment of the land and the water and so on. So, and obviously there's an investment there that that they have this person or this team which deals with this aspect. Now, does that have any value whatsoever? Do you think that does it have any real significance?
I mean, I'd be interested to hear what other people think. I mean, I can only draw on my own experiences. There's a McDonald's near where I live in Sevenoaks, and as people go through the drive-through and pick up their various McDonald's things, the cartons get thrown out of the car windows, and the roads decreasingly, as you go away from the McDonald's, there's masses of lift, it gets less and less and less, and then it increases as you get near the next one. They said in their local paper, we're very conscious about the environment, so we've got litter pickers going out and picking all this stuff up. They did for a while, it didn't last long. But I suppose the reality is, having someone saying, we are conscious about the environment and everything else, I think it's what I call a tick box thing. I think it's so that they can sort of put into their policy structure and everything else the fact that they are looking at this. But, they wouldn't need all that crappy packaging, I don't think. if the food was made just for being eaten and not necessarily being sold. I mean, coming back to, we're talking about McDonald's as well. McDonald's was also one of a group of very big, what are known generically as junk food or fast food companies. And I think Burger King, McDonald's and a few others got together a few years ago. And this kind of, I think, could be viewed alongside the fact that they've got a team looking at the environment. They looked at the fact that young people were dying, or people were dying 10 years earlier as a result of poor diets, largely to do with the consumption of sugars and fats and salts, of which a lot of fast food crisps and McDonald's and everything else is full of. And they began to actually crunch the figures and realise that if they sold slightly less of the junk, rubbishy food, children would live longer. And so they buy more food, and so it actually came down to money exercise, really, at the end of the day. It's probably worth making people live a bit longer because they're going to buy more food, and actually we earn a bit more money. So I would sort of view any initiative by those companies to deal with the environment alongside that sort of initiative as well, which clearly shows that their main concern, I think, is making money. I don't think that really answers the question. I'm interested to hear what other people think, though.
Well, I'll throw something in there. I think it was in the 60s, 70s, Ford made a car called the Pinto. What would happen with the Pinto, there was a design for. So if they got hit from behind, there was a very real chance that the petrol tank would split and there'd be a huge fire, and a really serious fire, and people were dying. So what they did, they got their accountants to work out, which way to go. And to repair the tank at the time, on a recall, it would cost about $12 to do something with the tank to make it safer. But they'd sold millions of these cars, and they figured that it was cheaper to pay the compensation to people who died in the fires than it was to make the cars safe. And that's what they did. Yeah. That was in No, it wasn't even. It might have been quite wrong. Some guy did I think it might have been on the electric car or something like that.
Who
killed the electric car? Anyway, it's over to you now. Bill.
Yeah, just three quick points. I mentioned about status symbols. I've seen old photographs of a turn of the century billboard in North London. You'll never own the tram. 4 pence a week will buy you a bicycle. So it's just as the same sort of logic back then. Well, obviously, in terms of sort of, I've put the cards on the table. I'm very in favour of heavy technological solutions, and there are some people who talk about vertical farming, and the idea that you build a 20-storey building and you farm on all the floors, and that, and you use less actual land, and you can rewild the wilderness. But obviously, even under present conditions, I mean, even accepting that people accept the logic of that sort of idea as a solution, it would ruin all the other farmers who are land-based if they tried to do something like that. So obviously there's no option now to apply technology in efficient ways. And of course, if all the genetically modified crops were nicely stored in a building, they wouldn't harm the outside environment as well. There'd be no weeds and fewer inputs. And just the third point, I'm not sure how serious or genuine this was, but there was an air conditioning company advertising that they think that they could build a 200-storey apartment block that could house up to 100,000 people. And they reckon they could throw that up in about 90 days with prefabricated parts. So there's kind of like the same technology comes around again to make life awful for the rest of us. Imagine 100,000 people living in the same damn tower block, that would be fairly strange. But again, obviously, the counterpoint to that would be you could rewild where the houses are and, let the trees grow, stuff like that. Mm.
I think it's interesting the point of using energy, isn't it? And trying to... it's often said, I mean, clearly, world population is an issue no matter what your political background. But I think one of the difficulties that a lot of people who are sympathetic to the existing society constantly say, one of the things they'll constantly say is, obviously they say we must keep growing. And they say, we need more energy. But the reality is, I think if you start to look at what energy is used for, and vast amounts of it is used for manufacturing packaging, manufacturing things with built-in obsolescence, obviously. So an awful lot of energy resources are to go into things that aren't designed to last anyway. And I think that as socialists, it would be difficult initially to understand quite what savings you'd make, but I guess they'd be astronomic savings in energy if you were in a society that was no longer focused on having to sell something. I mean, you probably have one or two very good products of certain things. You wouldn't need vast competition to try and beat the other one into the ground or sell something over and above someone else. It would all be made with one aim in mind, and that's efficient use of energy.
Yeah. I think it's very interesting what's kind of happened to McDonald's in the light of a protest movement. I mean, 10 years ago, in the late 80s, there was this What's Wrong with McDonald's leaflet that got prepared and put out by London Greenpeace, a kind of anarchist environmentalist outfit. And there was a big court case over it, and there were thousands of these leaflets put out. What's happened as a result, to a degree, is that, to my mind, the protest movement is more or less determined that you need to market yourselves in a better way and in a greener way. So instead of the bright red and yellow, shiny seats and stuff, they're now sort of dark green. And they look very green and more kind of holistic and in tune with nature than actual McDonald's there.
Like the new BP.
Yeah, and they market themselves as producing their burgers from organic beef as well and things like that, and they have probably more salads and stuff, yeah. I'd be interested to have a conversation with what the actual people who, they put so much focus on fetishising big business, and at the end of the day, if there was that much focus on, the root cause of problems, then, maybe it would change the relationship to the means of production. It's still the same, despite the greenwash,
Fitzer.
Yeah, what Glenn had to say on the one, it was all very interesting and fascinating.
say, but the travel and holiday thing particularly interested me, because I think socialism, as Glenn was explaining, would make an enormous difference, not just to the idea of holidays, but a whole way of life of a huge section of the population. Now, in the sense that these days you've got a lot of people from developed countries who've travelled far more widely than would have been the case about 50 or 60 years ago. But what has that travel really involved for the most part? Maybe a fortnight in Spain, a fortnight in Thailand, or a fortnight here, a fortnight there, and then they're back to their familiar smog and grind, their place of employment, etc. As Glenn was, I think, quite clearly putting it, there would be a lot of people who would spend months, years going from one place to another. They might well settle for several months. They might settle for years or so, and not in one particular part of the world or another part of the world. But I think an interesting consequence of that would not just be the length of time in which people might spend in different parts of the world, but also what they're doing there. These days, when people travel abroad, the vast majority of them are staying in high-rise, sanitised hotels. They may be on the beach or by the swimming pool in the Caribbean or in the Mediterranean. I think socialism, as Glenn was clearly indicated, that type of experience would be just a minute portion of travel, but it would almost certainly involve people finding out far more about the local way of life and experiencing, most importantly, the local way of life, the food, the culture, and mixing with the local people, maybe learning some of their languages, etc. Rather than the English person who goes abroad, or the American tourist who goes abroad and thinks that everybody will speak English. So I think that travel and travelling around the world and being in different parts of the world under socialism would be totally different from the experience today, and would be a far more positive and enriching thing, a genuine mix of cultures.
I think when we travel the world, don't expect to find too many locals, because they'll all be doing the same thing as us. Yeah. They'll all be somewhere else.
Yes, but they
would.
Yeah,
that was a great thing. I couldn't resist being silly there. Yes, sir.
Yeah, two quite separate points, actually. One Richard Jefferies, whom I'm a fan of. What is interesting when you read people like Richard Jefferies and W.H. Hudson, you really get an impression of what Britain was like at the end of the 19th century, in terms of the diversity and the abundance of wildlife, you know. I mean, Jeffrey's got to mention, you know, sort of 7 or 8 weasels running over the path, as it were. I mean, when did you last see a weasel?
Yeah.
And W.H. I didn't mean Lewis, and in the 1890s, W.H. Hudson, who was he was born in Argentina, actually, but he wrote on British, the British landscape and whatnot. And he used to go on the downs near Lewis. And he wrote a book called Nature in Downland. And he used to go and chat with the shepherds, because he also wrote a book called The Shepherd's Life, which is an interesting book. And W.H. Hudson used to go on the downs near Lewis and chat with the shepherds and all that. And to earn a bit of money in their spare time, the shepherds up on the downs there used to trap wheat ears. which they used to sell in Lewis Market for food, you know, and it was just a bit of spare income. And they would think nothing of trapping, you know, 30 or 40 wheat ears on the downs, you know. I mean, you'd be lucky to see 30 or 40 wheat ears on the downs, don't you?
What is a wheat ear?
A wheat ear, a little, oh, I'm sorry, it's a little bird. It's a migrant bird that winters in Africa and spends the summer in Scotland mainly, you know. So that is quite interesting, because it's only you see things relative to what was that you realise what we've lost, actually. The other, when I got interested in ecological issues in the 1970s, a long, long, long time ago, and when Rachel Carson's book sort of came out, she's often treated as the iconic figure, you know. At the time, and very much now she's remembered. But when I was interested when I became interested in ecology issues, which was a kind of second wave movement of ecology, because there was an ecological movement with William Morris at the end of the 19th century, you know? So like feminism, there was a kind of second wave interest in sort of ecological issues in the 1970s when I was a young lad. What was interesting then, ecology then was seen as an extremely radical, subversive kind of movement. And there were two figures that were important, actually. Not Rachel Carson, you know, not Rachel Carson. Actually, the two figures that were important, and I used to read a lot, and they've both been forgotten, these. One was a chap called Barry Commoner, who was a Marxist and wrote a book called The Closing Circle. And it was about within the ecology was the closing circle. And the other was Murray Bookchin, who was a kind of anarchist and things like that. Now, what was important about both these blokes was the stress that the reason there was an ecological crisis was because of capitalism, you know, which was completely missing from Carson's book. So, I mean, she was mainly interested in the environmental impact of what, and like I said, she came in for a lot of stick. But they were actually explicitly saying, you know, the reason that we have a problem and there's an ecological problem, that you can be put at the door of capitalism. So both of them. But sadly, those two characters have, you know, have been bypassed and forgotten.
That's probably why.
In a way.
Yeah, Andy? Oh, sorry.
To me, it's the Industrial Revolution, actually, that has started the real problem, because the Earth can only exist if we have a proper recycling of everything. Now, with industrialisation, and I don't care whether we live under capitalism or under socialism, we're not going to give up our inner comfort. And to make that, we've got to use energy and a whole lot of other things that produce toxins that we can't get rid of, nature can't get rid of before, because we didn't make them. Nor at that size. And so either the people here would have to go back to the style of life where it's total recycle, or you're not going to give it up, and you're just slowly going to put these toxins in so that we extend our life, but we're still going to kill ourselves in the end.
I'm not sure I agree with that, I have to say. I find that as a little...
When you're making up, like with the new drugs, if you go into a laboratory, the amount of, you know, toxic and volatile things that you use that have had to be purified, you know, it's and the length of time that it takes to come up with a new drug can be extremely long.
What is the length of time? Got, with all due respect, to do with...
Well, because you're using all these solvents in the meantime.
Yeah, well, I think technology and coming up with good drugs is a good thing. On the subject of drugs, at the radio the other day, these big companies now, GlaxoSmithKline and so on, are getting terribly cheesed off because some of their patents are coming to the end now, and the generic drugs are starting to get used, and they now want some money from the government to invest in new drugs and so on and so forth. But surely, I mean, as I said earlier, I think a lot of these toxins, if it's cheaper to produce something and get rid of the toxins in a damaging way to the environment, they're going to do it. I mean, in a society where it wasn't an issue and you could manage your waste properly, and you know, maybe instead of having 10 companies trying to do the same thing, you've got the better minds together to do one, therefore you're producing less. I mean, I can't see quite how... I think if things were managed better and there wasn't a need to do things cheaply, so that the top arsenic didn't get chucked into rivers, so stuff didn't get put into landfill unnecessarily, because it would be in everyone's interest for it to be done properly. At the moment it isn't. That's the problem, I think.
Well, you see, that's what I mean.
You're not thinking... I said you're a bit pessimistic.
If it was that easy, then, for instance, making electric energy from coal, we could easily then... If science is that easy, we could easily also stop some of those gases go up into the air. But it's not that easy.
You're not necessary.
Become?
Not necessary, but in a society with new economic vectors...
Can we go this through the chair, please, Comrade?
Sorry.
Okay. Was there anybody who said that right up before that? Okay, then, wait, go. Comrade.
I just wanted to say that it's just difficult to divorce our minds from the economic paradigm of this society to think about a society where there are no economic considerations or chains binding us into economic or environmental considerations might come into place, but only the very best conditions will be taken in a future moneyless society, which will obviate all these problems. And I know it's very difficult to catapult your mind into this situation, but it'll be a completely different transformation of society in general.
Well, if you could tell me how to extract certain chemicals we've solved from nature.
Thank you.
The risk of having the second slot. This is the shoes on the other foot. This is actually the tragedy of the commons that they try and use against us. But the fact is that the oceans are the commons, and the air is the commons, and the land is the commons. If they don't own it, they don't actually have to calculate it into their prices. Then they will just pollute. Whereas if we were properly managing the commons collectively, which is what we suggest, then we will be able to take into account the damage it will do to the wider environment. And also, I mean, one thing that's important to remember about the way the pricing system works is it's not an objective measure of anything. All it does is it tells us how easily the current setup is set up to do something. So at the present moment, because the infrastructure isn't there to deal with pollutants or to recombine them or to produce them into, turn them into something else, then it becomes expensive to do that. And obviously one of the most polluting industries obviously is gold, because they use a cyanide compound that they invented in the 1960s, and they drastically improved or increased the amount of gold that's taken out of the earth by an incredible amount, but it is hideously... Well, what would we need gold for?
This money's not worth anything anymore.
Is there anybody else? Yeah,
I was just thinking of the recycling absurdity in Britain and abroad. Things, plastic bottles and cardboard are collected by the councils or for the councils by private firms. And this so-called recycled stuff is shipped abroad for low-paid workers to pick over and then recycle and then shipped back again, you know. And you just think of all these resources that are going into, I mean, the shipping fuel, to go abroad and take advantage of low-paid workers, non-unionised staff. They've got no protection, no health and safety, etc. That's one of the absurdities of capitalism, that it can have this green halo about it, but it manages to subvert it all and manage to do more harm than good in many ways. I mean, recycling is great, but all the fuel and energy that it takes to recycle it under capitalism is quite absurd.
What are your thoughts are on nuclear power, as to whether or not the advantages of that outweigh the disadvantages, either in sort of a capitalist context or in a sort of a socialist context? So I was just wondering
you know, just sort of in general what your thoughts are.
Yeah, as you know, my I'm not a scientist, and you know, my sort of humble offerings to the summer school are just, you know, based on my concerns and thoughts about the environment. You know, I'm not a scientist, but I mean, certainly people like Lovelock think there's, James Lovelock thinks there's no other answer now other than nuclear. But I suspect he's coming from a capitalist standpoint. And I think that, you know, most people who believe that energy must carry on increasing to meet the demands of the burgeoning population, a lot of those people think nuclear is the only answer. One of my best friends works at Sellafield, and he utterly contends that it's incredibly safe, incredibly clean way of producing energy. And in a socialist society, it may be that it is chosen as part of a group of methods of getting energy. But of course, one of the worries now is, you know, how do you dispose of the spent uranium and terrorism and then getting hold of it and that sort of stuff. But of course, in socialism, the terrorism issue just wouldn't come into play. In answer to your question, I suspect, you know, with an increasing population, there may be a case for it. I think it would probably be dealt with, and the safety aspect would be far more sensibly dealt with under socialism than they are now. And I think perhaps it would be used as part of, you know, as I say, other types of energy production. But I can't contribute much more than that. I'm, you know, I'm not a, I really am not a scientist.
Just thanks for your talk, Ben. Very interesting. You make the points logically. You make the points very well. Why the device is there. What I come across when I get the time to do it, of explaining these sort of socialist ideas, is the comment, it never happened. Mm-hmm. It happens so often that sometimes I give up even speaking about it, possibly. Mm-hmm. Now, this response comes from intelligent people as well. Mm-hmm. So I think the great difficulty for people who are socialists is you discuss things with people, and they find opportunities to do it. When you come out with very logical processes, very logical ideas, how things can be improved and made better, and everyone have a more fulfilling life, it'll never happen. Mm. I mean, how has this ever combated? How did it ever deal with it?
I absolutely agree with you, and I have the same thing, even with my own partner, who came from an extremely Tory blue background. I talked to her a lot, and she said, do you know, I've never thought about these things before. I see what you're saying. But even she cannot see, she says just that, it'll never happen. And it's incredibly tricky. And I think one of the things I find terribly sad is that, you know, if you have a meeting at head office or indeed here, with what to us, presumably everyone here, I'm not sure if it's people, but let's assume it's most people here, seems like an eminently sensible human way of managing our affairs on the planet. Why is it this place isn't packed? Why aren't there just loads of people banging on doors to get in and hear about this? I really find that a problem. I cannot really understand why, to be honest, because it makes absolute sense to me. And yet there are countless more people sort of following some other ridiculous organisations. I don't know. I think it's not really the answer, and I know I can get... I get chopped down a bit for thinking this, but I do worry... Sometimes with when one discusses with people socialism and you're coming across a new group of people, you have to break down the initial wall of their perception of socialism, which might be Gordon Brown, it might be the National Socialist Party of Germany, or it might be whoever it is, or Russian communism. That is one of the problems you immediately got to surmount before you even begin to start talking about it. And I think that is, to me, is a problem. And I think, you know, the SPGB is, as I understand it, Danny knows more than I do, I'm sure, is probably the oldest socialist party in the UK, I think. But it's still a problem, because you've got to break down that barrier first, and then you start talking about other stuff. They say, you know, I absolutely agree with you, and I don't know the answer. I find it disappointing.
I think, first of all, what you just said is absolutely correct. Most people are either confused by visions of what is socialism or rhetoric of socialism. Secondly, a lot of people are sort of fobbed off by capitalism. You know, they buy into they're getting on and doing well. And, you know, if you're looking at property, if you're not looking at country and garden or something like that. You're not really looking at owning property. But I think what socialism is confronted by is the contradiction of socialism, and that's that the ideology, the ideal is to sweep away the system and to bring about something that you're looking to achieve. But every day people are confronted by the concessions that are fought for and won within the system, and by fighting for concessions people start to believe that it's controllable and it's that capitalism is actually okay because you can win rewards. But of course as soon as the capitalists concede ground, as soon as the possibility arises, they start to grab it back, as we've seen since the post-war era, we've seen since Thatcher, that they're taking back all that they provided when they needed to provide it. So that's the contradiction between evolutionary socialists and revolutionary socialists. That's the problem we confront it, day-to-day humiliation.
You make an interesting point about, you know, this idea of people feeling they're doing well in capitalism, because I think that's quite an interesting one. And I think if people feel they've won a bit of that ground, like the government says, right, this year we're going to give an extra 10p a month to the pensioners, you think, oh, that's not right. Until you actually realise what that actually means, you know, 10p a month, you know. I mean, it's not, the socialism, I think, you know, with a socialist society, one of the great things that is completely lost in a capitalist society, and more so as each year passes, is what actually is a quality of life, what actually makes people really happy. And allegedly, material things and welfare was increasing, and as that lady correctly said about talking about the Industrial Revolution, things got worse and worse and worse, but it got better and better and better up to the point in the 60s when the graph allegedly split and people's wealth, if you like, was going up, but their happiness was going down. At that point, it split. And I think, you know, we're talking about the environment, and some of what I was trying to get over, perhaps not well at times, was that chap working in the woods, for instance. There's an awful lot of pleasure to be had by sort of hearing birds and looking at a sky, or having time in your life to enjoy things that aren't shopping or aren't sort of the search for something that you're never going to get. And I think that's something that I think socialism would definitely allow people to do. As Vince was saying, you know, if you're travelling, it ceases to be a two-week manic trip to somewhere. You know, you start thinking, it's not a holiday anymore. A holiday wouldn't exist. Your life would be, for want of a better word, a holiday. You know, people would enjoy their lives, and they might travel to somewhere, but the whole experience of life would be so much more enriching.
Finish on what I was saying.
Sorry.
I studied under a professor who's got a very good website that may not totally agree with on the political point of view and everything, but he's, don't know if you're aware of his website, Robinson Rahas Archives. He's a professor of, I studied under developing societies with him, and lots of his stuff in great detail was on there, and he's constantly making economic comments about the system and using the Financial Times to support his arguments. It's an excellent website. I suggest if anybody's interested in it. It has an A to Z on it, and it deals with politics, economics, the whole thing.